I'm Christopher Lydon with Elizabeth Warren. She's the cutting edge of the Democratic Party on the money issues in 2012. She's the public advocate who told Michael Moore in his movie about capitalism that you cannot buy a toaster in this country that has a 1 in 5 chance of blowing up, but you can buy a mortgage with a 1 in 5 chance of exploding, and the lender doesn't have to tell you it's dangerous. She's in a close race for what used to be Ted Kennedy's seat in the U.S. Senate from Massachusetts. This is Open Source, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. This one is on stage at the John F. Kennedy Library overlooking Boston Harbor, with one half of the hottest Senate race in the country this year. Republican Scott Brown, who won the tail end of Ted Kennedy's term 2 years ago, declined this session with Elizabeth Warren, but everybody's open to finding another date for a meeting like this one with Senator Brown. Elizabeth Warren, by way of introduction, grew up, as she says, on the ragged edge of the middle class in Oklahoma City. She was the state's high school debating champ at 16. She went on to public university in Texas, then law school in New Jersey, on her way to becoming a chair professor at Harvard Law School and a prolific author on bankruptcy and other perils of modern American life. On the day we met, she was celebrating the second birthday of the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, which she designed for the Obama administration. This is a funny event somewhere between it's not a campaign event, it's not a seminar. I'd love to just think we're sitting on a park bench sort of puzzling about what we, Massachusetts.
There are 600 people watching us here. Okay.
No, but what are we going through? You're a famous researcher, a famous reformer. Congratulations on the CFPB.
Thank you.
But how does it look different from main streets of all these Massachusetts towns you've never heard of before, Draycott and Belchertown and Seekonk and places that they have to tell you is not pronounced Leominster and places like that? What do you see out there?
So what I see is that people are living day by day, minute by minute, the effects of a system that has been rigged for the big guys. And that they're just getting crushed out there. And that they know it. They get it.
I was going to say, do they know it?
Oh, I think so. I think so. In fact, I'll tell you the hardest part about doing the campaigning now. It's that I go out, I talk to people, I talk a lot about what's changed, why it's changed, and we can talk more about that. But it's the shaking hands afterwards. Mm. And that's when people tell their stories. Mm. So just a couple of days ago, I met a young person who said to me, I did everything you all told me to do. I worked hard. I got into college. Mm. I studied hard. I borrowed money to go to school. Mm. Now I've graduated. I'm working a part-time job. Mm. I've got $78,000 in debt. Got no hope of paying it off. I've moved back in with mom and dad. What I want to know is, are you going to fight? You're going to fight for me. That's what happens. The hard part is people get what's happened. It's that they want to know, is it really possible to get any change? It's not just the corruption in the financial system. It's what's happened to the political system. They want to know if it's possible to change things. And that's what being out on the stump is all about. I'll tell you something. Running for office, it's a real act of optimism. You have to believe that if we all get together, we can make change. Mm.
The handshaking thing is important. It's very touching. There's something vaguely sort of sacramental the way people hold your hand. Mm-hmm. And then they say good luck, which always mystifies me. Is it sort of good luck or good luck? But let me just be bold with the observation that it seems to me your issue, including the history of the CFPB, mm-hmm. has become white hot, and yet I'm going to venture the observation that somebody's told you to cool it a little bit.
Yeah. but that's not the first time somebody's told me to cool it.
Well, there's something funny there. You have to be an awfully nice girl to run for office and not be too strident or too depressing and not condescending about people's problems. How are you working that?
All I know to do is get out and fight for what I believe in. Mm. I mean, and that really is all I know to do. I can't change who I am. It's too late. I'm kind of stuck with who I am. But the truth is, somebody's got to get out there and be willing to fight. Families really are getting rolled over. And even families who are making it from here to there, they worry about what's going to happen to their kids. What's going to happen to their grandkids? Are they going to grow up in an America that still has opportunity? Are they going to grow up in an America that's creating jobs? Are they going to grow up in an America that still has that optimistic spark that our kids are going to do better than we did and our grandkids are going to do better than they did? Or are they going to grow up in an America that's all about protecting the big guys?
3 years ago, when you were working on CFPB with those hearings, including the famous, and everybody should know it on YouTube, the stare down with Timothy Geithner, you said that what was clear in a certain way to everybody, but you were discovering for the first time that the big financial institutions were beating up on working American families, and you almost apologized for saying, I'm profoundly shocked by it. It is profoundly shocking. Are you still shocked? Are people shocked? Or are we in a sort of psychic numbing about what's happening, as we were in a certain way in those years of nuclear confrontation? We just can't quite deal with it.
Well, you know, it is the case that we're now in a world of scandal heaped on scandal, right? It started with the one I was but part of what I talked about was the whole mortgage scandal. Out there falsifying documents, making loans to people that someone knew couldn't possibly be repaid, but hey, you got your fees off the top and sold it up the line. You were cheating in both directions. And then that was hard on the heels of that was the discovery that the mortgage foreclosure companies, now that things had really gone south, that they just deliberately figured out that following the law was not the profit-making alternative, and they could make much better profits if they just violated the law. So we get into wave two, right? We pass the financial reforms, and then it turns out, as I mentioned, that J.P. Morgan manages to take on the kinds of risks with no oversight that they lose billions in weeks, and now it's the LIBOR interest rate fixing. You know, this one goes right to the core. This is corrupt right at the heart of the system when you're talking about interest rates.
No, but it's almost beyond absorbing. A young Democrat friend of mine tweeted this morning, the parade of bank scandals without action is comedic at this point. I mean, it's some...
I'm not laughing.
Neither am I, but we're waiting for something. Barclays Bank in England pays $500 million in a fine. And the president, Massachusetts-born, Concord Carlisle High School, Robert Diamond, is somehow disappeared very quickly. Mm-hmm. But we haven't heard a word of prosecution. Nobody's been held accountable. Trillions of dollars worth of financial instruments are riding on this gamed interest rate. How do we deal with it? Why isn't the government doing something about it in the way of major whistleblowing?
Yeah. So you were right. I think the real question, I think the touchstone here is accountability. We are now 4 years into this financial crisis, and the people who broke our economy have still not been held accountable. And so the real question, and it's been scandal after scandal since then. So the question now, and I think that is the question in front of us, is it just the financial system that's broken, or is the political system broken as well?
Is there an answer, or? I mean...
Well, let me put it this way. We have come to the fork in the road. And this is part of what I believe the 2012 elections will be about. It will be about the vision of accountability. I want to be careful here because I understand this is not a political forum. But I hope everybody
We're
saw...
We're just talking about our country here.
That's right. But I hope everybody saw the videos of Mitt Romney saying... On the first day, if he is elected president of the United States, he will repeal all of the financial reforms that are in place. In other words, he wants to roll back. His answer for what's broken in the financial system is to reduce the amount of regulation, to cut down on the number of cops on the beat, to say to those guys as clearly as you can, go forth and do whatever you do best. And the alternative vision is to say, no, we got to have some rules. And we all need the rules. Families need the rules. The banking system itself needs the rules. It cannot survive over the long haul if it's crooked at the center.
But can I ask you, I mean, my puzzlement just watching the game is simply, why don't the Democrats have a short list of things we're going to do next week, including prosecute the banks, prosecute open manipulation for years of interest rates, restore Glass-Steagall, separate boring commercial banking from casino banking.
Right.
I mean, everybody knows that's a terrible problem.
Right.
While we're at it, undo the George W. Bush tax cuts for rich people, and I mean, just take them off the books. While we're at it, in the way of economic justice, why not a $10 minimum wage, which Jesse Jackson Jr. says would bring us back to 1968 levels?
Right.
And why not? Where's the campaign for public financing of our democracy? It is openly, disgustingly up for sale. We'll talk about the fact that you're the biggest, the best financed Democrat in the country this year, this side of Barack Obama. But we all know this stinks to high heavens. Why don't we have a quick and easy palm card program to get to the bottom of it?
So I appreciate the palm card, and look, this is part of why I'm running for office. But look at just the last one you mentioned, and that is money and politics. We had a vote just yesterday on exactly that question. Everyone in this room remembers Citizens United, where the United States Supreme Court said that the richest people in America, the biggest corporations in America, can seize the electoral process and squeeze as hard as it wants, and it will be constitutionally protected in doing that. But it did leave open one part. It said it is permissible for Congress to demand full transparency on that, to say that if you're going to get out there and put $50 million into negative ads against someone in this independent expenditure group, Congress can demand that it be transparent, that your name be out there, that, you know, and it be searchable within 24 hours and so on and so forth. That's known as the Disclose Act. So Congress tried, the Senate tried to pass the Disclose Act. There was a vote on this yesterday. And again, I'm just reporting the facts. My Republican opponent, Scott Brown, and every other Republican filibustered so that the people who are pumping money into these independent groups can remain secret, can remain in the shadows, can remain behind the curtain. So it's not that no one has tried, but even the smallest reform has been blocked by the Republicans on this one. And that's just wrong.
How do they get away with it? And I mean, that sounds partisan, but what I mean to say is, why is your race close?
So actually, let's talk about how do they get away with it? So that vote was yesterday. Did anyone look at the front page of any of the local newspapers today? How many had a 2-inch headline saying, Scott Brown voted to keep big money secret in politics? I could have run that headline a lot of different ways. I didn't see that in the papers. How many heard the first story on, who's sponsoring this? WBUR?
Among others, the
WBUR.
Did anyone hear that?
I'm just talking about the media. Did anybody hear that story as the first story this morning? While I was listening to the radio when I got up this morning, I didn't hear anything about it. Was it on the televisions this morning? No. The whole point is those have just been pushed away, those stories. These are the stories that are central to the functioning of our democracy, and these are not the stories that are front and center in our public conversation.
And they're not simply partisan either. I was very touched by your story of Ted Kennedy saying, is it good for working families? I'm for it.
That's right. That's all he asked.
But you told a very important story a few years ago. I don't think you tell that anymore, about Hillary Clinton in the White House wanting to meet you and to talk about protection of credit card holders who were in the most desperate trouble and bankruptcy as a refuge. Mm-hmm. And you had done critical work on bankruptcy. You were for the bill. She heard it. You said you never met a mind that could absorb a public issue faster than Hillary. And
that's
she said,
while she ate a cheeseburger.
And she said,
multitasking.
She said, I'm with you. She got elected to the Senate including Wall Street, and she said, sorry, I can't vote with you anymore. And you said, if she can't take the heat, who can?
That's right.
How does Mrs. Clinton, how does the state of New York, how does media, well, as you say, media deals with significantly by denying it, just forgetting it. Look someplace else. Find a ball score. Find an Indian ancestor or something. I mean, this is a really puzzling and problematic symptom in a big world power, a great empire under distress that we don't notice. We don't hold people, including Mrs. Clinton, responsible.
That's right. And in fact, the way I see this is this really is democracy 101. So let me
say
it.
We're in plutocracy. Harold Bloom likes to say we're in part plutocracy, part oligarchy, part theocracy, but it's not what we call good old big D democracy.
And that's what we have to fight for. That's why I said I think we've come to the fork in the road, and that's what we have to fight for. You want to know something I'm actually really proud of? I don't think you get to talk about things you're proud of, but I do. I will. More than 40,000 people here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts have contributed to my campaign. And more than half of the contributions are $25 or less. That's democracy.
But not more than half the money.
No.
I gotta check you.
But
more than half the money, and you've raised twice as much money as Scott Brown. I wanted to ask you, can a woman raise $25 million for a Senate fight? I mean, JFK, you remember him quoting his father saying, look, we can take care of this election, but I can't afford a landslide. Think what JFK would do with $25 million in a U.S. Senate race, I mean, in a Massachusetts Senate race. You wouldn't believe it. Can one raise that much money and not become part of, as you say, the boys club, the old boys club?
So here's how I see that. Nobody's fooled about what I stand for. And when they make a contribution...
Nobody was fooled by what Hillary stood for on the credit card bill either.
Oh, I think there's a real question about what people run for. And that's what I think this whole election is about. I've stood up and said what I believe in. I haven't had to trim my sails one bit for one nickel. That's not what this is about. I got into this race not because I'm a lifetime politician, not because this was a great career move for me.
Could be.
Yeah.
Are you going to be the keynoter at the Democratic Convention?
So, for me, what this is about is about these key principles that are at stake. That it really is, like I just said, there comes a time when it's not a fight you plan to have, but it's kind of like with Senator Kennedy. You ask the critical question about what's involved, and then you say, I'll do it. And I just put it out there. That's all I can do. I'll do it. And people have said, I'll contribute to that financially. People have said, tens of thousands of people here in the Commonwealth, I'll help make it happen. I'll come volunteer, I'll knock on doors, I'll make phone calls for you. I'll stand outside when it's 95 degrees and hold a sign. Did anyone see those people? God bless them. For me, that's what this is all about. This isn't my campaign. This is our campaign. And it has to be that kind of democratic sharing, small d democratic, that says, we have a chance to take our government back. That's why I said, running for office, for me at least, is an act of optimism. I have to believe that. That's what you have to believe to be in a race like this.
Come back to the big picture. You know, everybody knows intuitively that something's happened in our world, that finance is the most powerful, the most profitable industry in our country, makes nothing. It has created a new class, a new curriculum, half the Princeton class goes to Wall Street. I mean, it has completely reshaped and, for old-timers like me, misshaped the priorities of the country without any palpable benefit. People talk about hollowing out the middle class. There are many ways to describe it. Everybody, I read so many books now that locate the problem in the mid-70s, late-70s, somewhere. Something happened. You've written a powerful book yourself about the two-income family that didn't produce savings or leisure or privilege or education. It produced debt and borrowing, et cetera, et cetera. For me, the most satisfying general picture is a wonderful little book called Ill Fares the Land by a New York University historian, Tony Judt, and his sort of big three things. We've come to worship money in a truly golden calf sort of way. Secondly, we've let go of those basic institutions, public education, and every measure of the things that keep a society healthy that he grew up with, and to a large degree I grew up with, and I think you did. And third, we've somehow lost a public conversation, despite the web, despite every kind of technology, from Facebook to otherwise. People don't feel included in the public deliberation. I want your, just the Elizabeth Warren big picture, explaining to your great-grandchildren what happened in this wonderful, proudly middle class. We assumed it was a share-alike kind of general, proud country coming out of World War II. What's your theory of what happened? How would you explain it to God, to your kids?
So I think it starts during the Great Depression, a very dark time for America, and a time when we looked into ourselves and made a decision about what kind of a people we are, what kind of a country we were going to build. We decided to make investments in ourselves, in our kids, in our future. And we did that three ways. We invested heavily in education. Think about it, for 50 years, we invested in education. From Head Start to public universities, NDEA loans and a GI Bill, on the theory that if our children are better educated, they'll have more opportunities, whatever it is.
Can I interrupt you? Yeah. Just one sec. Why are we talking about containing the increase on college loans, interest, when the world we live in and compete with and share so many things with in Europe and in Asia sends kids to school free? Our kids have $1 trillion of college loans on their backs, and they're supposed to save our economy, save our society.
That's right. You preach to the choir on this one.
Why don't we hear Democrats saying we're going to pay for public higher education? It's as an investment in our future.
And it is an investment, and that's the real point. There has been so much support withdrawn, ultimately, from what it takes to educate a child now. So I'll just give you the example for public universities. A young person going to a public university today will pay, adjusted for inflation, on average, just for tuition and fees, more than 350% of what her mom or dad would have paid just 30 years ago. Right. We have just increasingly said two things to kids, two things. You have got to get out there and get an education. Now, it could be technical training, it could be university, but you have got to get post-high school training or education. That's part one, or else you don't have a shot at being middle class. And part two, and you're on your own to pay for it. The most we will do to help you is lend you some money. That does not help us create a future. And so if I go back to this story. So the story is, we invested big time in education. We invested big time in infrastructure, in roads and bridges and sewers and power, communications, all those things that said, we don't know what the next cool business will be. We don't know who will start it, but we're pretty sure you're going to need to get your goods to market, and that means roads. We're pretty sure you're going to need an educated workforce, see education. We're pretty sure you're going to need to plug in. So all of us invested in creating the conditions so businesses could start, businesses could flourish, they could build opportunity for all of us. The third big thing we invested in, and it's been remarkable here in Massachusetts, we invested in research. in building a big pipeline of ideas, basic research, scientific research, medical research, the whole notion that we would build a big pipeline of ideas, not knowing who would start a business, who would cure something with it, but it would create opportunities. We made those investments for nearly half a century, and it worked. You watch GDP adjusted for inflation goes up. You watch median family income go up. So families are getting better. We all did better when we all did better. Families did better when the country did better. When the country did better, our families did better. And then, starting about 30 years ago, we just moved in a different direction. We had a different leadership. They told us something different. They said the job of government is not to make the investments together that none of us can make alone. The job of government is to protect those who've already made it. And we ended up with 30 years of underinvestment. So now we live in a world, China's investing 9% of its GDP in infrastructure, building a future for its kids. Here in the US, we're at 2.4. Research budgets as a proportion of GDP over the last 45 years has been cut in half. And like I said, education, we have shifted over to our children or to families individually to pay for it.
A lot of people want to blame Ronald Reagan, and maybe he should take a lot of the heat, but I mean, did we do this with our eyes open? Were the Democrats in on it? Was Bill Clinton not in on it? God knows George Bush was in on it. But I mean, why? It's still a puzzle to me that a free country has sort of been nudged into this.
We have tested two ideas. For 50 years, we tested the idea of if we make the investments together, we build opportunity for ourselves and for our kids. And it worked. We have now tested for about 30 years the notion that if we just cut taxes and leave it to the wealthy, if we just deregulate and let people do what they want to do, let the largest, most powerful institutions do what they want to do, that somehow the scraps from that will feed the rest of us, that it will somehow make the rest of us wealthier. And it didn't work. And so now where we are is we have come to the fork in the road. We have got to choose which of those two visions guides us. And I believe what this choice is it's an economic choice. Make no mistake, but it is also a moral choice. It is a question of what kind of people we are.
You know, I have this vaguely sort of waiting for Godot feeling. I mean, we're waiting for something. And what you just said reminds me of that famous line, Harold Macmillan supposedly was asked, like, you know, what crystallizes an ambiguous situation? What actually changes policy? And he said, events, my dear boy, events. We're waiting for an event. And your Senate race may be one of those events.
I mean,
no. And I have to be sort of neurotically nonpartisan here, but I mean, I didn't mean to say that you're going to save the world. But if Massachusetts chooses the other guy, that's an event.
It is.
And if they choose you, that's an event too. To my mind, this LIBOR scandal and the Barclays Bank story is an event. It hasn't been recognized as an event. I mean, people have to help conspire to recognize an event as an event. But I wonder, aside from your own election, what kind of event do you pray for, hope for, dread, imagine? What is the thunderclap that's going to clarify this very strange state we're in?
You know, I have to say on this, you asked two different questions. If you ask the question of clarification, of course, but that gives me the choice, of clarification, I think every day that goes by it's becoming clearer. I think every vote that Congress is taking is making it clear. Sure, there's the job to be done to get out there and talk to people about it. But there was, you know, the votes are making it clear whose side you stand on. We have come to the fork in the road, and it's pretty clear that there is a difference, and it has been laid out. If anyone doesn't see it, it's because we are willfully blind on it. It's there. So that part I see. You ask me what I pray for. I pray that tomorrow morning Congress would get up and make some changes. I pray that tomorrow morning they would get up and say, you know, this isn't right. We're going to have to make public who it is who's putting money into these campaigns. I wish they would get up tomorrow morning and say, this isn't right. We've got to make some investments in infrastructure. We got people who are unemployed, and we've got work that needs to be done. Let's put those together, give those people paychecks, and get this economy moving forward. Those are the things that I pray for. I want to see the change. See it now.
Okay. From the floor, a couple of questions. From Jordan Asher of Newton, the debt has become a controlling issue in all policy discussions these days. How do you think we should consider the debt, especially when thinking about public spending?
Right. So here's how I like to just think about the issue. Think about everybody in America, just including corporations, who just pay a certain amount, right? Kind of like a flat tax or something. The question is, how are we going to spend that money? And think about three boxes. The first box is we can spend that money by giving special breaks to those who can hire an army of lobbyists. Think of the oil industry. Made $137 billion in profits last year and is still sucking down billions of dollars in tax subsidies from the American taxpayer. There's something we spent in the first box. Think about hedge funds, right? Think about the Buffett rule, okay? All the folks who get special breaks because they've got a lot of power in Washington. That's box one. We spend a lot of money there. Box two, the deficit. We have this huge deficit problem now. Box three, making the investments in our future, in education, in infrastructure, in scientific and medical research. My view is you stop spending in box one, and then you decide how to spend between box two and box three. For me, while we're still trying to pull out of a recession, you spend a lot in box three and a little bit in box two to start paying the debt down. Over time, as the economy recovers, as more people have jobs, as it picks up, you spend more and more in box two to get that deficit down. But
whose taxes are you ready to raise?
Oil companies.
Sorry?
Oil companies.
But the very rich?
But here's how...
I mean, what about the big incomes that the Bush administration virtually exempted from taxes and the Obama administration has left blissfully alone?
Well, I support the Buffett rule. I believe that we ought to let the Bush tax cuts expire on the wealthiest Americans. I don't think the middle class can take it right now. They can't take it. The middle class cannot take a tax hike right now.
They did very nicely in the 50s, 60s, 70s.
Yeah, when they weren't getting slammed by the rising cost of health insurance, by the rising cost of sending a kid to college, by the rising cost of transportation, by the rising cost of housing, and by flat incomes. It is a different world for America's middle class than it was in the 1950s. So, but I want to make this point because I think it's an important point to make. You talk about raising taxes, the frame itself loses half the game. The oil companies, there's just an example. The oil companies are getting money the same as if they paid regular taxes like everybody else, and then the U.S. government wrote them a $4 billion check and said, here you go, guys, enjoy. Instead, they build it in through taxes and say, oh, what you want to do is raise taxes. No, what you really want to do is say, stop subsidizing the guys who've already made it. I don't want to hurt them. I just want them to play on a level playing field. We don't have the money to be subsidizing the largest and wealthiest corporations in America. We can't do that anymore.
Can I just say, I think it's still puzzling to some people, many people, many, many people, that the remedy for the bad tax cuts is not to restore the taxes as they were.
Well, but we just...
We're
in a recession, or we're coming out of a recession. I shouldn't say we're in a recession. We're coming out of a recession. We're in... The middle class has just been hammered. I don't know how to say this any more clearly. Every single thing you look at, middle class has been hammered, working families have been hammered, the poor have no place to go. It's not creating opportunity, it's not creating jobs. This is a huge part of our country, of our economy. The question right now is fairness in the system. Those who have more need to pick up their fair share. That's where we've got to start this conversation.
Second and last question from the floor. Mm-hmm. Dodd-Frank is being eviscerated by lobbyists, same bill whose passage you want to celebrate, but all of its best features are disappearing. What will you do about it? What can we do about it?
Okay, so I want to say the first thing. Not all of its features are disappearing. That consumer agency is out there and working. And the importance of that, because there's something to learn from that. The consumer agency is up and running because it was set up effectively to be politically independent. That's what makes it work, is that it has a mission, it's clear what its mission is, and it's politically insulated from much of what's going on in Washington. Now, there are four bills pending right now to change that, to change its funding, to change its jurisdiction, and the biggest one, to just repeal it outright. So it's under assault, but until they manage to break through, the consumer agency is actually doing what it's supposed to be doing. So you bet I'm going to stand up and celebrate it on a regular basis, because people need to know that about it and say it's worth hanging on to. The harder part is where all of the financial rules and regulations that were pushed to the agencies to be written, and then, boy, Congress got its toe in it. Look at the House of Representatives, right? Cutting back on the budgets, for example, for the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. You say to them, hey, you got to write a whole lot of rules that are technical and difficult, but we're going to make sure you don't have the resources to do that. And what kind of hearings has Congress been holding? Take a look at the House hearings. Just look at the titles of the House hearings. Have the regulators been too aggressive in how they deal with the banks? I'm paraphrasing, but they keep hauling the SEC in, they keep hauling the Commodity Futures Trading Commission in, and other agencies in Washington to say, have you been too tough on the largest financial institutions? Congress is in there, folks in the House, undercutting. The lobbying has been going on from the Senate and from the House to delay, to create loopholes, to create complexity in the system, to benefit the largest financial institutions.
A lot of people know, and a lot of people felt at the time when the agency was created, that of course you, who had conceived it in many ways, should have been running it. President Obama decided that there was too much heat from the lobbies to make that a wise move, and the Obama administration, from all we read, encouraged you to run for that open, not quite open, Senate seat in Massachusetts. conclude by a sort of a general observation on that as a sort of a career path. Would you advise people to, you know,
spend 30 years doing something else and then, go off into
regulation to out there on the hustings, building a public constituency for your work as a first-time candidate. Would you advise young people into that sort of choice? And I hope you would.
So I would say it this way about the way all of this unfolded. It wasn't about me. This was about the best way to protect the consumer agency, and that's what I care about. The best fights are the fights that are about something big enough and important enough to be worth fighting for. They're the fights that are bigger than you. It's really a sense of giving yourself up to the fight that needs to be fought and to recognize it's not me, it's all of us. I just agreed to get out on the point position and try to give it voice. But that's what this is really about. This is about taking our country back. And this is about standing up and saying, we're not putting up with a corrupt system anymore. This is our country.
May I just say for everybody, thank you. And I'm so glad, again, not in a partisan way or anything, but I'm so glad you're running for office in Massachusetts.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
What people see coming over the next 3 months and some is a close race and a reasonably civil one. Elizabeth Warren and Scott Brown have both agreed not to allow any freelance attack ads against each other. Ms. Warren sounds more urgent on the issues. Senator Brown may have an advantage in laid-back likability. Both have lots of money to spend. The Warren campaign will put a lot of it into door-to-door field work. If there's a puzzle to be solved, it's why a Democrat with Obama backing in the Kennedy state is not better than even at this point. Maybe you can explain it. Leave a comment, please, at radioopensource.org. Mary McGrath produced and edited this conversation. Thanks to Tom Putnam and Amy McDonald and the staff of the Kennedy Library for their invitation and their help. And thanks, of course, to Elizabeth Warren. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.